Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College, all things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there, and of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. I think I'll call her Colonel Ernst, retired Iowa National Guard Army Reserve this morning, because we begin. Good morning, Senator. Welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Hey, great to be with you, Hugh. Thank you.
What do you know about what's your response to what Israel did overnight?
Well, at this point, Hugh, I only know what is publicly available. I should learn more today as I go into work at our beautiful nation's capital. It is in response, of course, to the attacks on Israel over the weekend. And there is a very clear difference here. You know, what we saw with Iran and their attacks on Israel, you know, hundreds of drones and missiles and very little damage done to Israel. What we saw from Israel was a very, very measured, targeted response. To me, it just shows the superiority of Israel and what it is capable of doing versus what we saw was more of a demonstrated weakness coming from Iran.
Senator, there are many reports, and I haven't been able to nail them down yet, that Israel used something new, a different kind of missile. And you're on the subcommittee on emerging threats on the Senate Defense Committee, and I already referenced your military service.
Mm-hmm.
Should we expect to know the specifics of what Israel used and if it was a razzle-dazzle, something that stunned the Iranians on how precisely it could hit and how it got past everything?
I don't think that Israel wants us to know exactly what they are using, and again, I think that's okay. I want them to have cutting-edge weaponry and platforms. They live in a very dangerous area of the world. They are surrounded by those that are perpetuating the support for Hamas. So, yes, I anticipate that it probably is something that they have recently developed or do have in their toolbox. I don't think we'll know right away exactly what it is. I think we can learn that in upcoming months, maybe. But certainly, I'm glad that they have the capability to defend as they do and to attack as they do. They have every right to exist, and they have every right to strike back against those who come at them.
Now, Senator Matt Continetti, who is clearly one of the most dominant views of the next generation behind me, more of your generation, he works at AEI, writes for the Washington Free Beacon. He's on the commentary pod. His column this morning is that Israel was right to disregard Team Biden's urging that they not do anything. I agree with Matt on that. Do you?
Absolutely, I do. I see Israel and much of the world that is in chaos as direct result from the appeasement of Joe Biden and his administration. We absolutely have to stand with Israel. Israel has a right to defend itself. The result of Biden's appeasement, you know, he has told Iran, don't, over and over again. Well, it means nothing when you've appeased them for 3.5 years. The Biden administration's, they've failed to enforce the sanctions. We've seen Iran's oil revenue go to a 5-year high. That's $80 billion of revenues for Iran that's directly funding their war against Israel and funding, not to mention the American troops that have been killed. Just recently, we had 3 American Army reservists killed at Tower 22 in Jordan. You know, those missiles and drones that attacked Tower 22, those were bought and paid for with Iran's oil revenue. So President Biden needs to grow a spine and start pushing back against these authoritarian regimes.
Senator Ernst, I want to interrupt you there, though. I have watched President Biden this week pretty closely. Physically, it is a very unfortunate thing to see. He is infirm. Do you believe he's actually running the national security response? I think it's the triumvirs of Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, and Defense Secretary Austin. I don't think it's President Biden. Do you?
I don't think he's capable. I don't think he's capable. No, you're right. He is infirm. And so I think it's those he has surrounded himself with, or maybe a few others. But most certainly, this is a man who, in my estimation, he cannot lead. He's proven that. And whether that was willful in the past or not, just his appeasement. But I think as we move through the years, we see an ever-increasing failing Joe Biden.
Senator, when you go around the Hill, do people talk about, like, the cannibal story that he came up with this week? I mean, do they, in the cloakroom or at the conference meeting, do they look at each other and say, my goodness, cannibals?
Yes, actually, we were laughing about that yesterday. Where does this stuff come from? And I'll point out one that I think is absolutely horrible. I have a friend who lost her husband in Afghanistan. She is a Gold Star wife. And just recently, over the course of the Christmas holidays, she had been invited to the White House, as they often invite Gold Star families in. And he reiterated the story that he lost his son in Iraq.
Oh, my.
Now, he continues to either lie about it or he simply can't remember.
You know, and Senator, you're too young to remember 8-track tapes. You're too young to know
I do remember those.
Okay, well, then you were in, like, third grade. When they begin to skip, they just kind of go different places and you got to throw them away. I think his 8-track tape upstairs is skipping. Senator Donald Trump, by contrast, went to the bodega up in Harlem, comes out at court every day and lets everybody have it. Energy to spare. I think he's going to get convicted anyway. It's a New York jury. I think that will be overturned because it's a nonsense lawsuit. What do you think that trial is doing to American politics?
I think this is absolutely horrible, Hugh. It is just crazy the way the Democrats are pursuing Donald Trump on nonsense charges. And you see the exact opposite in the Senate, where we had the trial. Well, we were supposed to have the trial of Secretary Mayorkas, where we actually had evidence and proof that could have been reviewed, and the Democrats just simply dismissed it. So on one hand, they're bound and determined decades later to continue going after the former president of the United States in a bogus charge. And then you've got right there in the nation's capital, you've got Democrats who are like, oh, yeah, there's all this evidence, but we're not going to allow you to bring it up, and we're not going to have a trial in the United States Senate, even though it's our constitutional duty.
Senator, yesterday Michael Waltz pointed out that he had gone and reviewed the documents that Special Counsel Robert Hur looked at. He is shocked at what was in those documents. I don't know if you have them. I don't think you're on the Intel Committee. You're on Armed Services. But have you heard that report that the Hur documents, the ones that Joe Biden had, were very, very troubling?
Well, yes, and I do trust Congressman Waltz. He's a good friend, and I have not reviewed the documents myself. I'm on Armed Services. I could go review those documents, but I know exactly what I heard in the public space as well. That is plenty troubling right there. I see what Joe Biden is doing. I see that he is infirm, as you stated. And I don't know how he can be the candidate for the Democratic Party, other than he's a useful puppet right now.
I think you're right. Let me ask you about Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. The new Fox polls came out, and you're next door to Wisconsin. You must know Wisconsin pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
It's tied. What do you think that said? I know, you know, the former president is going to win Iowa handily, but what, you know, Wisconsin well. What do you think is going to happen to the state to your north?
Well, I think he's going to win.
Trump.
I think he's got momentum on his side. He's leading in a number of really important swing states by anywhere from 2 to 8 percentage points. And if you just look across the country, and I think Wisconsin is probably a pretty good barometer, Americans are just sick of suffering under Joe Biden's policies. So just as we talked a minute ago, he's such a disaster on the foreign stage, on the world stage. But right here domestically, you know, he has failed the American people. So I think Wisconsin goes the way of Donald Trump. I think a lot of these polls, I think they're actually pretty conservative in their numbers, because Trump, as you know, will have a lot of voters that don't participate in polls or may not answer truthfully in polls. So I think there is a lot more support for Donald Trump out there than what you're actually going to see in the papers, on the TV, and here on the radio.
Now, 2 weeks ago, the former president told me Israel needed to finish the job and they needed a victory. That means going into Rafah. Do you support, despite what Joe Biden has said and Jake Sullivan has allegedly said, do you think Israel ought to go into Rafah and finish the job with Hamas?
I am going to support Israel, whatever they decide to do, Hugh, because that should be my role, sitting in the United States Senate with a good friend and ally in Israel. It is not up to America to tell Israel how to do their job and defend their country and wipe out Hamas.
But you just came back from Ukraine as well. Are you in favor of the aid package that looks like it's going to get out of the House this weekend?
I am. I am in favor of moving forward on a supplemental package. I do caveat it. We'll see what comes over. But my mantra for U.S. foreign aid has always been weapons, not welfare. So whether it's Israel with the right to defend herself, whether it is Ukraine, you know, getting the weapons to pound the bloody hell out of the Russians, whatever that is, we can provide the weapons. We are the arsenal of democracy. And I know a lot of those lefties, they hate it. They hate it. But we can provide the weapons and the munition in order to at least give these countries a fighting chance to push back on these authoritarian regimes.
If you
have that opportunity, we should do it.
Can I keep you for three more minutes, Senator?
Yes,
I would like
to
hear about Ukraine. I'm going to go to a break and then come back with Senator Joni Ernst. We'll post it on the podcast today. Dwayne will transcribe it and post it as well, because I want to hear about what Ukraine is. Even as we focus on Israel's retaliation against Iran, precise and with new weaponry, it is said, that will shock the Iranians. Stay tuned. I'll be right back on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm joined by Senator Joni Ernst. Senator Ernst, I'll play this in the next segment, but thank you for staying with me. You just came back from a CODEL to Ukraine, and when I was talking with your staff setting up the interview, we didn't know Israel would attack overnight. We didn't know the Wisconsin polling would come out. What did you see? What did you do? What do you think the United States should do?
Well, first, I'll start with that last question. I do think that we need to supply Ukraine with the munitions that they need. We need to provide them the weaponry they need to push the Russians back. So right now they lack on air defense munitions, interceptors. We know that they would like to have fighter jets for air superiority, which would allow them to get the Russians back even further, perhaps back into Russia. There's a lot that we should be doing there. But as I traveled across the country of Ukraine, it was a bipartisan delegation that traveled. We went to Kyiv, of course. We went up to the northern region, up closer to Belarus and Russia, and visited a number of villages up there where the Russians had committed war crimes, atrocities, killing women, children, raping women, taking elderly hostage, putting an entire village in the basement of a schoolhouse for a month, where they had to stack up dead bodies in the corner because there was no room for them to move around the basement. It was suffocating down there. We heard all of these stories as we moved across the country and talked to the local population. In Odessa, we were able to visit the port. Oddly enough, later that night, the Odessa port was struck by the Russians. This is Ukraine's one way of moving grain and goods out of their country. Believe me, folks, Ukraine is desperately trying to support itself. If anything, we should be able to provide them the means to support themselves. They are providing fighters to the front lines. They're not asking for American troops on the ground, which I think is a benefit for the United States. If Russia does take Ukraine, I guarantee they're going to be knocking on our NATO friends and allies' doors, and then we will have Americans involved.
So my last question, Senator, we're in the election season, and obviously inflation, abortion, the president, former president being persecuted, Israel all going to matter. How much is national security going to matter? I'm always interested in it, but I know it's only 3 or 4% of the population that votes that way. But in this election, it might be decisive that the Republicans support Israel and the Democrats don't.
Right. I think it is pretty decisive. And I think Americans pay attention. I know, you know, moms and dads out across the nation, those families, they have a lot on their plate right now because of inflation and domestic issues. But folks, all of that will not matter if we have Russia coming after us, if we have China coming after us. This is important stuff. So as long as we can keep the rest of the world strong and free, we can be strong and free. But I always believe national security includes protecting ourselves domestically. And we didn't even talk about the southern border, Hugh. That is a disaster. And that plays into our national security as well. The Chinese are sending Chinese nationals over the southern border. That's a whole nother story for another day.
Our next interview, Senator.
We can't do it all.
Our next interview. Thank you so much for joining me. Good luck on the Hill today and getting that package passed and over the line on Sunday or Monday. I appreciate your joining me. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. William Goldman famously said, nobody knows anything about what's going to work at the box office when it comes to the movie. And this morning, nobody knows anything about what Israel did to Iran last night, but they did something. I'm joined by Ben Domenech, editor-at-large of The Spectator, Fox News contributor. Ben, I'm sure you've been up and looked around a little bit. Anything to add to what I just said other than we know that Israel hit something with something in Isfahan?
We know that they hit something with something, and it made a loud noise. And beyond that, we don't know much, actually. And I'm sure we're going to learn more during the coming day about the detail that went into this. Obviously, that there was going to be a response to what Iran did. Iran will seek to downplay the damage, I'm sure. And Israel, at least is going to check the box here. But I think, one of the questions we have to ask is what the Biden administration's response is going to be to this, because of the tensions between the White House and Israel's leadership. This is going to be something where, did they play a role? Did they influence this decision in some way that maybe had Israel holding back from what they would have liked to do? And I think that that's a legitimate question to ask.
There are lots of questions to ask, including, did they trade Rafah for an all-out reprisal strike?
Yep.
And indeed, are they done? We don't know if Israel's done. We don't know anything. I just want to stress, it's going to be a hard day to be in the news business beyond 3 hours, because I've already told everyone everything that we know, which isn't much, Ben. So what do you expect? They're all reading each other's websites and trying to figure out something new. They're trying to make a big deal out of Ben Gavir posting on Twitter, lame, as though that somehow shifts the strategic balance. We just don't know.
Yeah, I think one of the things that, by the way, Hugh, this is one of the areas where, you read things like the focus that a place like National Public Radio had over the past decade plus of shifting so much of their coverage to DEI-focused things, and you start to wonder, how much of a percentage of the news space that we used to rely on for foreign-focused reporting, whether they were good at it or not, they were at least something. It has been shifted to these ridiculous navel-gazing activities here in America as we've seen the news business really change and in a lot of ways crumble over the past 20 years, we just operate on a much more limited, you know, resource basis now when it comes to foreign reporting. And obviously, you know, on the center right media, you know, we're limited as well. We just don't have the manpower to necessarily have the far flung bureaus. And you certainly don't see any of that from CNN, even though they can afford to have 8-person panels on, you know, whatever it is that Trump did yesterday.
Yeah, you know, we do have two reliable sources. The Times of Israel is a great aggregator, and they've got a lot of reporters in the field, and the Financial Times. I trust these two sources. They've told me everything I trust at this point. There are lots of other rumors and speculations, but first reports are always wrong. Ben, you just mentioned the Trump trial. I played a little bit of the former president's statement, which is pretty much the same statement he made the day before. I think every day that he walks out of court, he's got a captive audience of the country. And he ought to make other points besides the courtroom proceedings. What do you think he ought to be doing with his time after court each day?
Well, you know, I actually wrote yesterday that, you know, the problem for Trump at this moment is he seems to want the election. We know he doesn't want the election to be about abortion or culture war issues. We know he wants it to be about immigration and the economy. But it seems like the third thing that he wants it to be about is his own self-persecution. And I think that it's a mistake when he misses that opportunity. He should be talking about other things. He should be talking about things that matter to the American people and throwing as much in there as possible. Because, as you said, he has a captive audience. He has the equivalent of all the cameras, you know, on him. And that's something that I think that he should be using to his benefit. Either whenever he comes out, he can easily be talking about the issues that matter most to the American people. And saying, you know, in the time that I've been on trial this week, this is how many gotaways that happened on the border. This is how many things, you know, Joe Biden didn't do that he needs to be doing. And I think that that's something that, you know, really would play to his advantage and to his strengths. You know, it is, I think, an opportunity that he shouldn't miss.
You know, Ben, I'm a doodler and I'm a note taker. And that doesn't look like the former president is, which is too bad because he could be auctioning off all those doodles and people could buy doodles from the trial.
But I mean, a whole legal pad full of Superman logos?
Yes. And just say, we're going to raffle off one of these to everyone who makes a small contribution to the campaign today. Get your small dollar donor up. But generally,
now you're thinking like a Trump campaign man.
No, I am. I'm trying to get inside the head of a fundraiser. I do note that the new Fox Battleground polls show him ahead in Michigan on both a five-way and a two-way race, ahead in Pennsylvania in both a five-way and a two-way race, and tied in Wisconsin. What do you make of these numbers, and do you think Bobby Kennedy is actually going to impact the Michigan result?
I do actually think that he will. And I think that, you know, what we see currently when it comes to, you know, these early polling, you know, we always have to keep in mind that third-party candidates diminish as time goes on, and people naturally go to their partisan directions. But the fact that Bobby Kennedy is apparently going to be able to be on the ballot in Michigan on one of the small third party that already has ballot accesses there, which has chosen him, that's a very significant thing. And I think that it could play out as being something that is a real problem, especially for the Biden effort. It's why you saw them kind of pulling out all the stops and having all these Kennedy family members come and endorse Joe Biden. But I don't really think that that matters to the people who are in favor of RFK at this particular moment. It certainly hasn't put a dent into any of his appeal as we see it in some of these critical states. And look, you know, we're political nerds, so we want to see interesting things happen. The possibility that you have him, you know, making a significant play in one of these states or perhaps more is something that we all, you know, look through the lens of in the case of Florida and Pat Buchanan or in the case of Ralph Nader in the past. And that's something that I think, you know, a lot of people will be paying attention to and operating in a time, of course, when we have two candidates who are more unpopular than any two candidates that we've seen run against each other before. And that's something,
Ben, I got to ask you about this.
New precedent.
The president has not addressed the nation after a week of extraordinary tension, and he hasn't said anything. Meanwhile, he went to a gas station in Pittsburgh, and people kind of shrugged their shoulders. He gave a couple of sets of remarks that left people bewildered by what he was talking about, cannibals and his uncle. And physically, he just looks terrible. Do you agree with me on that last point?
Well, definitely on that last point. He looks so much worse now. Just if people think he looks bad now, just go back and look at some of the things that he was saying and doing even a year ago. Sometimes this kind of blends together because we don't see the contrast. Even a year ago, he looked better. Even a year ago, he was more coherent than he is now. And the whole, you know, look, it's one thing to say, you know, the president's focus, the president's, working all day on what the American people are care the most about. And then they trot him out there, and he talks about his uncle getting eaten by cannibals, which is not something that happened. And it's something that completely damages the White House's attempt at making some kind of momentum out of things. The other thing is, frankly, you know, he doesn't have a plan or a solution for anybody in that Pittsburgh gas station about how to make any of the prices there go down. He doesn't want to actually do anything to address our deficit spending. He doesn't want to actually do anything to roll back any of his inflationary policies. In fact, I think he'll lean into them even more as things go on. Now, he wouldn't be able to make all that much of a difference between now and the election if he was to change course. But he doesn't even have a plan for post-election to change course.
So, Ben, I think Speaker Johnson's going to pull this off this weekend, that we're going to get aid for Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and the American industrial base, as well as banning TikTok. What do you think?
I think he is going to pull it off. The level, it's interesting to me that the House Freedom Caucus, as much as they are infuriated by some of the decisions he's made, they actually haven't come together around negativity on him yet. And they have expressed the doubts internally. It's reported, and I'm hearing this as well, that making a shift at this point in an election year away from Johnson would be particularly damaging for them. Now, you know, look, for Johnson, I don't know what his long-term political future looks like. I don't know if he's going to be Speaker, if they maintain the majority. I don't know if Steve Scalise will slide into that job or we'll see some kind of other candidacy. But certainly in this situation, I think he's found himself in essentially the same situation that Kevin McCarthy did, dealing with the same dynamics and the same math. And look, as long as we have this single, motion to vacate being able to be put forward to hold the whole crew hostage, things are going to play out the same way.
But he's refusing to be held hostage. That's what I like.
Yeah, I
admire that he's moving forward, and I think he's got the votes to aid our ally Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, ban TikTok, and jam the Senate. I like that. B. Dominich on X. Follow Ben over on X. He's editor-at-large at The Spectator as well, Fox News contributor extraordinaire. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is and it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's
864-644-1900.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in... Anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Joined by my special guest, John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting fame. You may have heard me talking about John having been in Israel over the past many days. He's back in California. I don't know what time he thinks it is. His body must think it's like 4 o'clock in the morning. But John, good to see you. What are you over jet lag yet?
Hugh, I actually had to fly back to Portland and drive to Washington for a show last night to pick up my tour. So I'm not sure what planet I'm on, but I'm happy to be with you.
You're in Portland, Oregon?
We're actually in Olympia. We had a show in Olympia, Washington last night. And as I speak to you today, I'm in Seattle looking out at the Ferris wheel on a lovely Seattle day. So, yeah, I really haven't had much time to catch up. But it's certainly great to be home and great to see you.
Well, thank you for finding time for me. I'm fascinated by your itinerary. And I view this as both travelogue and doomsday scenario, but a fitting introduction to the weekend before Passover and the day of Passover. I'll probably play some on Monday as well. John, tell us, first of all, just the itinerary. When did you arrive in Israel? What did you expect to do before Iran decided to turn it into the start of the first open Iran-Israel war? And what did you plan to come home?
Well, I got to Israel, today's Thursday, a week ago, and I arrived Wednesday night. I had dinner with some influencers, a woman named Aviva Klompas, who's been amazing on Twitter, kind of documenting what's been going on in Israel and Hamas and kind of the abandonment of Israel. Met Ilan Levy, some of the folks that work for the Israeli ministry and their social media. And then the next day, I met with troops. You know, me and Gary Sinise love to play for our troops in America, and I met with injured Israeli soldiers, many of them amputees, and I played some songs, and I spoke to them. I learned about their experience, which was very moving. And then, Hugh, that afternoon was by far the hardest couple hours of my trip. I met with hostage families. And I keep trying to figure out how to best explain that experience. But there really are no words, you know, to listen to their stories, to look into the eyes of fathers who are children are still held hostage and feel that kind of that dread, that agony, that that never goes away. Every second they're thinking about what's happening to my loved one. And, you know, one of the things that happened when the 40 hostages were released, we saw and heard the stories of how terrible they were treated. And very little food, certainly the abuse, for some sexual abuse. So that was just excruciating. The next day I went to Jerusalem.
Okay, pause for a moment there. We spoke with you right after you had met with the injured soldiers. And you're not, no one ever gets used to it, but you are familiar with how to get comfortable with wounded soldiers. You've never dealt with a hostage family before, have you?
Not at all. That was something completely different. And, you know, the soldiers, yeah, they're injured, but they're young and they have their life ahead of them. And most of them are very positive and joking around. And so that was, you know, that was a very cool experience. You know, they actually gave me guitar lessons. Some of them were better than me. So you walk out of there just, you know, you're certainly sad for them, but you feel they're going to have a great life. But the hostage families and the hostage forum, they created a hostage forum immediately in Israel to support these families and to meet those people that every day are going in there working with the hostage families, hearing the stories. And there's become this split with the hostage families. You see some of the protests that are going on in Tel Aviv, tens of thousands of people, you know, many of the hostage families, and you understand it, are demanding, they're sick of waiting. They're like, we want action now. They're blaming Netanyahu. And then the other, you know, kind of half are like, let's kind of keep working the process. And of course, for them, there's no right or wrong answer. So there's a lot of kind of politics within the hostage families and the kind of situation there as well, which I you know kind of found myself in the middle of, to the point where they were not going to have the hostage rally Saturday night because there was so much tension. Eventually, they did, and I was able.
Well, John, were you able to navigate the hostage crisis, which is now being engulfed by Israeli politics, which is not beanbag ever? Were you able to stay the American who is rooting for all Israel against the terrorists, or were you drawn on to one side or the other?
I was not. They're so grateful to just have anybody there. You know, they've been, you know, they feel abandoned, Hugh, because they have been. They've been abandoned by, in many respects, our own government, certainly the world. The UN is basically a Hamas ally, and they've been abandoned by the artists of the world. You know, look, you know, I'm very low on the totem pole of, you know, of artists in America and in song, you know, in kind of American kind of pop music. But they were just so happy to have someone there who wasn't Jewish. You know, I'm just there to support them, to condemn the evil that's Hamas. So, no, they were very grateful to have me there. You know, that was the one thing that I could tell the hostages, family, hostage families, that you are not alone. Millions of people, tens of millions of people in America support you. They want the hostages home. They understand this is a fight for civilization. Don't just listen to the news. Don't listen to the loud media. Don't just look at college campuses. America does stand behind you. You wouldn't know that. But I think that was the message that I really wanted to get over on my trip, and I think I did.
Now, I'm going to pick up on what happens next, but I want to put a note in here. Guy Benson, Mary Catherine Hamm, and John Ondrasik are the three non-Jews I know who have gone to Israel. I was invited to go. They don't have a studio. I'm working with JNS.org. Mike Gallagher is a fourth one who's gone, and he tells me there's a studio in Jerusalem I can use, so I want to go and stand with him. But I am curious, did you run into any other non-Jews Americans on your time there, John?
No, I did not, which is
all right.
Sad.
I'm astonished. Let's go on with the trip. After you are at Hostage, was it Hostage Square that you performed at on Saturday?
Well, it's interesting. There was actually a little concert. It was a jam session on Thursday night at Hostage Square. Just, you know, it's just a big square, kind of like Times Square. Anybody can be there. And they had a hostage family of a hostage named Aviatar. And every Thursday, his family would kind of bring some people and play. And they asked me to come, and I did. And I played a few songs. There were very few people there. But after that night, the leaders of the Hostage Forum came up to me and said, look, we're really trying to get Saturday to happen. Would you play if Saturday happened? Because, you know, Saturday, there's 10,000 people there. It's broadcast on television. And I said, of course, I'm here for you. And then it turned out that that actually did happen. So I was very honored and grateful to play that.
What did you do on Friday between meeting with the hostage families on Thursday and then meeting, doing Hostage Square concert on Friday night?
Yeah, Friday we did go to Jerusalem. We went and kind of had a tour of David's palace that they're excavating. Certainly we went to the wall. We immersed ourselves in the culture. I actually didn't have a chance to have lunch, Hugh, because I went to do an interview with you. So,
oh, good.
So priorities in order, and then we kind of went back, and I had some meetings with some Israeli artists. You know, we're trying to do more. We're doing some more projects there. I went to a show with a famous artist named Danny Sanderson, who's kind of like their Brian Wilson. So I was having a lot of meetings with Israeli artists to try to do some collaborations, artistic collaborations, to fight this war.
Any Ukrainians with you, because they know you as the guy who came to Ukraine as well? Or anybody aware of the fact that you've become the wandering minstrel of freedom from Hollywood?
There was actually a woman named Oksana who used to be the chief of staff for the president of Ukraine. She's working with me on some of these collaborations because what we need to do, Hugh, is connect the dots. You know, this whole Israel-Palestine thing, there's so much kind of gray area, kind of think moral, you know, equivalency, that people are reluctant to talk about it. So I'm doing projects with Israeli artists, Ukrainian artists, Iranian dissidents, Palestinian dissidents, because that's what it's about. It's about the evil actors trying to tear down civilization, and they're all connected. So, yes, I had my Ukrainian contact there. I had some of the Israeli artists and some of their managers. So that was initially why I was going to Israel, to tell Israel that we support them, but also work on these larger global projects, because without the arts, there's no way to win this war. There's no way to change minds. There's no way to get to the kids. So some of this other stuff that happened was kind of something I didn't expect, but certainly something I was very humbled and honored to do.
Now, John, we just played a video of a very large crowd, the Five for Fighting set, and you are singing at Hostage Square. How many people are there? 1,000 people there? 1,500? 2,000? How many people are in Hostage Square?
you know, they have people surrounding because they can't get enough people in the streets, so they have videos all over the square. So I have to imagine there was, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 people, and they do that every night. And the families come and hold up the pictures of their loved ones. You know, Hugh, it'll remind you of 9/11 on 7th Avenue when you'd walk by and you'd see all the pictures of people who had been lost in 9/11. It really kind of brought me back to the concert for New York. And yeah, when I, you know, and I'd never heard an announcement before a gig that said, if imminent Iranian missiles start to fall, here's the actions you take. And you know the crazy thing, Hugh? Nobody left. Nobody left. If that was me, I'd be running to my safe room. So that just shows you the fortitude of the Israelis and their attitude of, yeah, missiles may be coming, but I'm staying here. I'm singing. I'm watching the hostage families. So to sing okay, you know, that really speaks to their plight, and have them singing it with me. Again, I can't put it into words. It was.
Well, how long was the set for? I hate to get into the nitty gritty with someone who jet lagged, did one show last night and has another show next night. But I'd love to know how long the set list was, and what did you play? Superman 100 Years? Did you play? Of course, you would have played OK. I'm not sure if you played the Ukraine song or the Afghanistan song. You've got sort of a trio of songs of freedom, which all come together on side of Just Cause. But what was the set?
They asked me to start with Superman, which was appropriate. And I talked about, you know, my experience at the concert for New York. And I kind of equated that to October 7th, because it is the same thing. And then instead of playing another song, I wanted to speak to them. And I told them that there was my first time in Israel, because I get asked two questions all the time. Why are you doing this? That's an easy question. You know, Hamas is evil, and if you don't stand up to it, you're participating. The second question's harder. It's like, where is everybody else? So I wanted to speak to them, and I said to them, look, I'm not Jewish. You don't have to be Jewish to condemn Hamas. You have to be human. You don't have to be Jewish to support evil. You have to stand for democracy, freedom, good, human rights. And I think that was the most important thing I did there. Singing the song was nice. Singing Superman was nice. But for them to hear from American non-Jew that we get it. We get it. And we're sorry that you feel abandoned. It's not okay. But, you know, you have the support of good people, of conscience. And I wanted them to know that. And I could see in their eyes and everybody I talked to how much it mattered. And it's a shame that we're here. But I think hopefully this will inspire other folks to go, because
yeah, going there, John, every time that the Daniil Hartman, Yossi Klein Halevi podcast drops, Call for Heaven's Sake, I listen to it. I listen to Dan Senor, Call Me Back. I listen to Commentary Pod. I did an interview with Jonathan Tobin. American Jews and some Jews in Israel talk only to each other. They don't talk to the Gentiles. And they underestimate, as a result, how many American Gentiles are with them. And so I'm glad you went. During the interview, during your concert, did the Iranian attack begin, or was your concert already over and your remarks already over when the Iranian attack began?
So it's so funny. Right before my performance, I actually met with your buddy, Michael Oren.
Oh, good. I saw the picture.
Yeah, we had a very nice talk. And I met with so many people, some in the ministry, talking about what Iran might do. And everybody had different suggestions. Well, they'll do nothing or they'll hit a base. But none of them said they're going to fire 300 ballistic missiles. So when I walked off stage and I was basically hugging hostage families, I was approached by the head of the Hamas forum. She said, hey, you need to be in your hotel by a safe room at 11 o'clock. And this was like 8:39. And I'm like, why 11 o'clock? Why not now? she said, at 11 o'clock, be in your safe room. So I'm like, all right. So after I kind of did my hugs and, you know, and talked to folks, I'm like, all right, let's go to the hotel to the safe room. And
was your son with you?
My son, Johnny, was with me. But typical Israelis, they're like, we have 2 hours. Let's go to dinner.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are crazy. You guys are nuts. That's these Israelis. They're like, yeah, we got 2 hours before the missiles start to fall. And I'm like, you guys. So we went to the hotel. We had dinner. And then at 10:30, I went up to my room. Of course, I'm following everything on Twitter. And then basically at the chime of 11, the initial drones were launched.
And so what did it sound like? What did it feel like? Were you worried about Johnny? What was Johnny doing?
Johnny was downstairs having a beer with some beautiful Jewish Israelis.
Hitting on the Israeli girls.
Yeah, they're gorgeous and wonderful. You know, it was tough because having Johnny there added a different dynamic. You know,
sure.
Between you and me, and because we're pals, my wife did not want him to go. And I was kind of like, I'll leave it to him, and he wanted to come. But the fact that all of a sudden we're under attack and Johnny's with me and you think about what the worst could be. You know, my wife was crying. Carla was like, get in on a plane now. And a lot of people were texting. So that was the worst part of it.
How old is Johnny? And
Johnny's 24, but he's a little baby. And
the IDF is all over Gaza, and they're 19 and 21. Yeah, okay. So Carla's not a Jewish mother.
You know, just walking down the street and seeing, you know, four 18-year-old girls who are barely out of high school in full army dress with machine guns, you know, you don't understand it, but you also see why Israel is still here and wins these battles. But yeah, so it was scary. And I'll tell you, you know, until they fired the ballistic missiles, I was like, you know, they're going to shoot him down. But once they fired the ballistic missiles, 12 minutes, right? Then they were like, all right, let's get right next to the safe room. And then for some crazy reason, I found myself on Fox News at 3 a.m. So it was the most surreal day of my life.
So, John, when you say a safe room, would you explain in some detail for the audience that's listening or watching on the Salem News Channel, is that in the basement? Is it concrete? Does it have a window on it? Because, of course, people who repaired to the safe room on the awful day of 10/7, many of them were murdered or kidnapped.
Yes. Yeah, so basically in Israel, every hotel, every house has every kind of building, office building has to have a safe room. And the problem that happened October 7th is the safe rooms are typically used for missile attacks. And a lot of families have small houses, so they may have their safe room be where their kids sleep because they don't want to wake them up and move them somewhere. And many of the safe rooms don't have locks on the doors. I met an injured man at Sheba Hospital whose hands had been basically melted, and he'd had 9 surgeries because when Hamas came to his house on October 7th on the Gaza Strip, he didn't have a lock on the door. So he was just holding the door with his family behind him, and they were lighting explosives on the other side of the door that got the door handle so hot that it melted his hands. But he did not let go, and eventually they left, and he saved his family. So that's something that I never understood. But at the hotel,
there's a song there, John. There's a song about hands. So how long were you in the shelter for? Was the shelter in the basement of the hotel, or was it in your room?
So every floor has a shelter on the floor. It's kind of where they keep some of the, you know, the towels and stuff. But it's reinforced doors, kind of like a submarine. The main shelter is in the basement. It's much bigger. It has food. It has water. It has bathrooms. So we never went to the bottom shelter. We were kind of literally 2 feet away from the safe room on the floor. We were looking out at the windows literally for missiles. So in Tel Aviv, there were some folks that did. Where we were on the beach, we never actually saw an intercept, and we never went to the shelter.
So how long did the bombardment last? I know that the missiles struck immediately. The drones were advancing for hours. The cruise missiles took 2 hours, and the ballistic missiles took under 20 minutes. How long did the actual cacophony in the sky go on for?
Well, we were given notice, as I said, at 11. And I think the first kind of missiles came in about 3 hours. So we really didn't get the all clear till 5 a.m. That's when I kind of was able to the IDF came on television and said, okay, we've handled most of the missiles and you can basically stop sheltering, you know, be aware. So it was really like 5 hours of Israel. But remember, coming from Iran, Tel Aviv is on the Mediterranean, so it's the furthest away from Iran. So what really scared me was when I saw some of the intercepts over Jerusalem, because what that meant was they were targeting civilians. To that point, we weren't sure. but certainly you saw that. And then Tel Aviv is about an hour away from Jerusalem, so we were expecting to see some of the missiles and intercepts. But I just think the Iron Dome, the all of the countries that kind of took out many of the missiles and drones that got there, and it wasn't just, you know, some of the intercepts. They have brand new missile systems, that the Arrow system that I'm learning about. It was so it worked so well that I think they got all the missiles before they could get to Tel Aviv. And
so, John,
without the Iron Dome, yeah.
How did the Israelis react the day after? Are they stunned? Are they ready for a fight? Are they going about their business and having brunch? Because it's not the it's not Sabbath anymore. Sabbath is over for 24 hours. What did they do in the streets on Sunday?
They went to the beach. They played volleyball. They rode their bikes. They went to dinner. You know, they were, I wouldn't say it was like a normal day, like the Thursday before, but if you had said nothing happened last night, I wouldn't have known any difference. Certainly, I think, you know, some people were probably staying home, but it was incredible to see, you know, literally the day before, you know, you couldn't get a reservation on Thursday night. And, you know, that was, Iran was still saying the attack's imminent. And the day after, you know, I went in the ocean and got stung by a jellyfish. So in my experience, the jellyfish are much more dangerous than Iran.
All right. So what day did you come back to the States, John?
So tried to get flights. Nothing was happening. They were canceling everything. I had a flight on El Al Monday night. And it's good to be on the Israeli airlines because they will fly when the other airlines don't. And United canceled. All the other flights were canceled. But I was on El Al. On Monday, I went and met with Natan Sharansky, which one is the most
probably powerful. I've met him once. That's a great honor in my life, too. Yeah, I met him at the Reagan Library, but you met him in Israel.
We spent over an hour together, and he had seen the OK video, but of course, Sharansky's from Ukraine. And we were talking about Ukraine, and I, an honor of my life, I was able to show him the Can One Man Save the World video. And frankly, he was very moved. And I think he looked at me a little differently after saying that, saying, you went there during the war. And so we talked a lot about the college campuses. You know, he said 20 years ago, Hugh, which is fascinating, the biggest threat to world peace and freedom and democracy is American college campuses, because he saw the money coming from Qatar back then. The guy's, you know, the guy's almost a saint. You know, he's the Mandela of Israel. So he saw this coming for 20 years. So we talked a lot about the college campuses. As horrible as some of my experiences was there with the hostage families, meeting Sharansky, you know, meeting the Israelis, it gives me hope. It inspires me. So that was a true honor of my life.
Then you come back to the United States with Johnny and you perform in Portland. I mean, you go right to the heart of progressive land. I hope you have a chance to listen to Dan Senor and talk to Professor Galloway.
Yeah.
Scott Galloway is a self-described far-left progressive atheist. He doesn't know where the Jews are in America. He doesn't know why they're hiding. He doesn't know why his agents are hiding. He doesn't know why people that he makes $1 million a year on the speaking tour. He doesn't know where all the American Jews are. And he's wondering, why are the Gentiles out there and the Jews aren't? So what happened at these two concerts, John Andrzejczyk, well, you've only done one yet. I guess it would have been in Portland last night. Anything at all? Is the crowd with you?
You know, I've been playing both. I play Can One Man Save the World and I play OK. I've been playing that this whole tour, you know, before I went to Israel. And I talk about what we talk about. I talk that they're moral messages. They're not political ones. And I tell them the hero of my video is a Palestinian woman calling out Hamas. And if you truly care about Palestinians, you need to free Palestine from Hamas. And when people hear that, I think they listen with an open mind. They certainly appreciate the Can One Man Save the World video. People very supportive of that. And after the OK video, I have people coming up. They say two things. Certainly, the Jewish people say thank you for saying this because they feel abandoned, because they are. But more importantly, and I told the crowd this in Israel, when I play OK and I talk about the meaning of the song and the fact that it's a battle for civilization against those who want to tear it down, non-Jews say, they don't say thank you for standing up for Israel. They say thank you for standing up for good. And that is the message we want to get across, because it really is good versus evil. I know it sounds like a cliche. I know it sounds like Reagan, access of evil, but that's what it is. So Americans get it, Hugh.
It is not. It's not a cliche. It's a battle for the West. Israel is a part of the West. In fact, they're the tip of the spear of the West. And Americans have to figure that out. And I hope your concert goes on and on and on, and that you play all the songs that I have enjoyed for three decades. But I really hope that you keep telling people that you believe in freedom and in human rights, because that's the bottom line, John. You're a human rights activist who happens to be a musician for a day job or night job, as the case may be. And I hope the crowds are good. I hope your American fans are applauding this. They certainly did when you were in Alexandria. Is that the case last night?
It is, Hugh. We get standing ovations. I think deep down, people know it's not political. They know it's a moral message. Afghanistan, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan. And I think we need to mobilize those folks. We need, the first line of my song is, this is a time for choosing. And I think a lot of people have wanted to bury their heads in the sand. But look at Colombia today. We have to make a stand. We have to join together, just like after 9/11, because the consequences are too dire if we don't.
So let's close here, John. How do people help you continue to do advocacy on behalf of the West? Because that's what it is. The video I'm showing, they can't go to Hostage Square. They haven't got the money. They haven't got the time. They're in America. How do they help you? What do you recommend they do? They can listen to a song. They can feel great about it. But what should people do?
First of all, talk to your Jewish friends and tell them that you feel their pain, that you support them, that you have their back. You will have no idea how much that matters. There's many charities that you can donate to that fight anti-Semitism. One is called Boundless Israel. If you just go Boundless Israel online, they do amazing work. As far as my things, if people share the OK video, I think the more people see it, the more it impacts. When Israel shared it on social media, it had a big impact. We're basically going to be posting my performance at Hostage Square in the next couple of days, after Shabbat, so the people in Israel see it. But, Hugh, we all have a role to play. You have your role to play. I have my role to play. No voice is too small. So just do the right thing. Sometimes it's about just doing the right thing.
And then I want to ask a personal question. I think Dr. Oren must be exhausted, because the ambassador never stops doing media because he's part of the international messaging thing. Did you go into his double secret studio and see where he broadcasts from in his safe room?
No, I was able to meet with him and his lovely wife in his beautiful Tel Aviv apartment overlooking the Mediterranean Sea. So, that guy, whatever he's doing well, because it's beautiful. And what a wonderful man. Thank you for connecting me with him. And his book is fantastic.
About 2048,
the future of Israel.
I hope he's right.
I just finished reading it.
I hope
Let's
he's
hope
right.
So. I mean, it's sobering, but I think a lot of what he talks about in 48 applies to America, because we're facing a lot of those same problems and a lot of the same challenges. So we could learn a lot from that book as well.
You are right about that. John Ondrazik of Five for Fighting fame, thank you for going for Israel. I'm glad you got back. I am glad you brought Johnny back, and I hope you will keep coming back. I'll see you on the East Coast this summer when you're touring. God bless you, and thank you, and have a good show tonight. Can't back you up. I'm really sorry.
Love you. Hugh, I love you. Thank you for all your well wishes when I was over there. It meant a lot that you were concerned, and I look forward to seeing you in person very soon. Thank you, my
friend. Thank you, John. Be well.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never before seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to salemnow.com. Salemnow.com.